we have a ministry, a film ministry called Adullam Films. And we were based originally in California, in the Los Angeles area. We were there for about 8.5 years. That's where we started the work of Adullam Films. The name Adullam comes from 1 Samuel chapter 22. It is the name of the cave that David fled to when he was being persecuted by Saul. And David fled to the cave of Adullam, and there all the outcasts of Israel gathered around him, and he became their leader. And then they went forth, and they fought against all the enemies of Israel. And of course, we've always thought it was a beautiful picture of our Lord Jesus Christ, who gathers the outcasts to himself. And so our ministry is about fighting the good fight of faith through our work in film and video production. But as Tom was talking about earlier, we've spent years working on a three-part series on the history of the Bible. The whole thing is about 9 hours long. And it covers the history of the Bible from the first century through the Middle Ages, and much of it has to do with the great Protestant Reformation. And what many believers, I think, find startling, one, many people know about the Reformation, and we're coming up on that 500th anniversary here this year. Many of us know about the Reformation, but many believers are not aware of the Counter-Reformation, and the fact that after the Reformation began, officially began, really, in about the year 1517 with Martin Luther, by the time you get to 1540, about 90% of the countries in Western Europe that had once been Roman Catholic countries and that were in submission to the Pope, about 90% of them, according to J.A. Wiley, turned away from the papacy and became Protestant Reformed countries. So in 1540, the Pope, Pope Paul III, commissioned Ignatius Loyola and a company of priests who called themselves the Society of Jesus. And their mission was to launch the Counter-Reformation. And what I want to do in this presentation is talk to you, and really, in short, the mission was to overturn the Protestant movement and literally bring mankind back into the Dark Age. Quite literally. Once you understand everything that their plan was set forth to accomplish. Even today, you will have, I mean, I was on a website not long ago from a university here in the United States that simply had a brief description of the Jesuit order and talked about how their mission is to reclaim all that was lost by the papacy in the Middle Ages, all of those countries. All right, so what I want to talk to you about tonight is why the Jesuits are important right up to this very day, right this very minute. What's going on in our country, what's going on in different parts of the world, especially in Western civilization, and what the Jesuits have to do with it. Okay, so right now we have in the Vatican the first Jesuit pope in history, Pope Francis. Pope Francis, first Jesuit pope in history. And very interesting how he came to power. For the first time in history, you had a pope, Pope Benedict, who stepped down before his time, his term in office was up. And many people believe he was pressured to get out because he was too conservative. That's, you go and you study what happened there. And so then they bring in Pope Francis, and Pope Francis begins to launch a very particular, I think, very left-leaning, very Marxist-oriented agenda. Much, much more liberal than Benedict had been. Right now, in Washington, D.C., the chaplain of the House of Representatives is a Jesuit priest. For the first time in history, we have a Jesuit priest who's the chaplain of the House. He was brought in by Nancy Pelosi, who was a Catholic, and John Boehner, back when John Boehner was Speaker of the House. The two of them were, John Boehner is also a Catholic, also educated in a Jesuit university. And both Nancy Pelosi and John Boehner worked together, and they brought in Patrick Conroy as the first Jesuit Speaker of the House of Representatives. He still holds that office. Gregory Galluzzo. Now, Gregory Galluzzo is a former Jesuit, but still very involved with the order. Gregory Galluzzo is the man who is generally believed to be responsible for the election of Barack Obama as President of the United States. Galluzzo and Obama knew each other. They worked together in Chicago. In fact, here's a quote from a Chicago magazine that says, quote, "It has been more than 4 years since Barack Obama threw an arm around Gregory Galluzzo and confided that whenever anybody asked how his presidential campaign had so quickly assembled its grassroots operation, he would credit Galluzzo, a former Jesuit." Now, Galluzzo, if you go and you read up on him, Galluzzo, there are quotes from Gregory Galluzzo where he talks about how he was and is a disciple of Saul Alinsky. Alinsky, who wrote Rules for Radicals, in the opening of Rules for Radicals, he dedicates it in part to Lucifer, who was the original radical, dedicates it to Lucifer. And Galluzzo has said that he is a disciple of Saul Alinsky, even though he never met Alinsky. So he calls himself the chief disciple of Saul Alinsky, even though he never met Alinsky, much like Paul, he says, who was the chief disciple of Jesus, even though he never met Jesus. That's a paraphrased quote from Gregory Galluzzo. And Galluzzo worked with Obama in Chicago, and they worked for years before Obama started running for president. And Galluzzo worked with Obama, and they began working with the Catholic priesthood there in Chicago to train them in the Alinsky-style methods, okay, of community organizing and so on. And what was in it for the Catholic priesthood, according to the articles that I've read, is what was in it for them was they were working with the Mexican population there, and they wanted the Mexican population to be going into the Catholic churches. So the idea was Galluzzo and Obama would work on the community organizing in such a way to encourage the Mexican population to go into the Catholic churches, and in exchange, the Catholic priesthood there would allow Galluzzo to teach the Alinsky-style methods to the Catholic priests. That was the exchange. All right, so let's go over some of the history of the order. Ignatius Loyola formed the Company of Priests. He was a former Spanish soldier in the 16th century. He was wounded in battle, and while he was recovering, claimed he had all of these visions of Catholic saints. In 1534, he formed a company of priests. In 1540, they were commissioned by the Pope, about 6 years later, to launch the Counter-Reformation. At the time of the Great Reformation, it was generally believed by the reformers that Rome was the fulfillment of Revelation 17, verse 5. That upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And that was how they saw Rome, this mother of harlots and abominations. There's a really powerful quote from John Calvin, where Calvin talks about how all of the great errors and heresies that had sunk the world in idolatry, he says, that all of them have either their origin or their affirmation from Rome. And as we go forward and you learn more and more about the Jesuits, you'll see so many things that are plaguing our society today really have their point of origin in the Counter-Reformation. All right, the Jesuit motto has been for centuries that the end justifies the means. The end justifies the means. And this is what has really gotten the Jesuits in trouble, not only with Protestants, but quite often with their fellow Catholics. Because historically, they're known for being very, very ruthless and for adopting unorthodox and often outright wicked and evil methods for accomplishing their aims. Whether it has to do with assassination, genocidal murder, adopting witchcraft, occultism, paganism, joining other religions, becoming Buddhists, Muslims, Hindus, atheists, etc., that whatever they have to do so that they can accomplish their ultimate aim of destroying Protestantism and reclaiming all that was lost because of the Reformation, they believe it's justifiable. The problem for them, historically, has been that not only did Protestants resist them, but often their fellow Catholics. They were kicked out of countries in Western Europe more than 40 times in the Middle Ages, and many of those were Catholic countries. Okay, so even their fellow Catholics kicked them out. In the 19th century, they were driven out of Spain at least 3 times. They were expelled from Switzerland in the 19th century. In fact, there was a civil war in Switzerland where you had the Catholics and the Protestants who were at odds with each other, and they had the civil war. At the conclusion of it, they both sat down and worked up a peace treaty, and at the end of it, the one thing they agreed to was that they would expel the Jesuit order and get them out of Switzerland. And they kept them out until the 1970s. They were expelled from Germany by Otto von Bismarck in the 19th century. I'll tell you more about that here in just a moment. Let's go through some of the notable history. At the founding of America, Governor John Winthrop, who was the founder of Massachusetts Bay and the founder of the city of Boston, when he came over on board the Arabella, he gave as the number one reason for the Puritan migration to America, he said, was to carry the gospel into those parts of the world and to raise a bulwark against the kingdom of Antichrist, which the Jesuits labored to rear up in those parts. And he said that because it was well known there were many Jesuit missionaries that had come into the New World. They were preaching to the Indians, they were trying to convert them to Roman Catholicism, etc. But when Massachusetts Bay was formed, they specifically put a ban on the Jesuits in Massachusetts Bay. They would not allow any Jesuits in their colony early on. Many people don't realize that in the American colonies, because of all the conflicts with the Counter-Reformation and the repeated efforts in England by the Jesuits to bring back the Inquisition, all of that led to a series of uprisings from the time of Bloody Mary. Then you get into Queen Elizabeth. She reigned for 40 years and England became thoroughly Protestant. Then after Elizabeth, you have King James I. Then you have King Charles I. King Charles I tried to bring back the Inquisition. I call him a closet Romanist. He was working with another guy named Archbishop William Laud, and they were trying to do these subtle reforms of the churches, and those who resisted their reforms were being punished. They had their ears cut off, they had their noses slit, they had their faces branded with hot irons, things that England had turned away from. And so ultimately, Oliver Cromwell and his Puritan army rose up. They overthrew King Charles I, condemned him as a traitor, and cut his head off. And it was later discovered that Archbishop William Laud, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury, who was also executed, had been working with Jesuits to undermine Protestantism in England. Okay, so the English Civil War was largely fought because of the instigation of the Jesuit order. Then you have the Jesuits manipulating King James II in 1688, and this led to the Glorious Revolution of 1688. And what happened there was the way that the Jesuits manipulated, which I think is very, very important for modern times, is they introduced a doctrine of toleration, an edict of toleration. And toleration is one of the weapons that they have used politically for hundreds of years. And many people are not aware of this. Right now, today, we always hear about tolerance, tolerance, tolerance. But and we can see how it's used as a weapon in our own society. But if you study history books, this is something that 19th century historians like J.C. Ryle and J.A. Wiley wrote about. And they wrote about how they did this with the Glorious Revolution. They had King James pass this edict of toleration that said, we're not going to discriminate against anybody in government based upon what they believe. And when everybody heard that, they thought, oh, that sounds good. That sounds okay. And then J.A. Wiley, he writes about this. He says that if they had meant it sincerely, well, then it would have been a very worthy thing to do. He says they didn't mean it sincerely. So Wiley calls it a treacherous gift a sweetened cup laced with poison. And then what they did was they gave forth this edict of toleration, and then King James began removing Protestants from offices of government, the military, the universities, and replacing them with these Inquisition-minded Catholics, putting them in positions of power. And so all the Protestants are watching this go on, and they're wondering what's going on. Then James passed another edict, and he started disarming the Protestants, taking their guns away. Now, prior to this, they had seen things like the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre. A lot of people don't realize the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre was instigated by the Jesuit order. And what happened was, in France, Catholic queen, Catherine of Medici, she and her son conspired together and brought about the slaughter of some 70,000 Protestants in France. So this happened shortly thereafter. Now you have King James II disarming the Protestants while keeping guns in the hands of all the Catholics. So the Protestants said, well, we're not going to wait around to find out what's going to happen. So they wrote letters to William, Prince William of Orange, and his wife Mary, who was an heir to the throne. And they brought in William and Mary, who were Protestants, and they told them to come take over the country. And this became the Glorious Revolution of 1688. Okay? And that's why we have the College of William and Mary here in the United States. It's named after this event, the Glorious Revolution. But the Jesuits were at the heart of that entire issue. And then you had the English. At that point, they passed a law in England banning any Catholic from sitting on the throne of England from 1688 onward. And that law stands to this day. Catholics cannot be a monarch, and they cannot be prime minister. Some of you may remember years ago when Tony Blair was the prime minister, and then he converted to Catholicism. He had to step down as prime minister before he converted. He couldn't finish his term because by law, he was not allowed to be a Catholic and prime minister. So that's why he stepped down prematurely. So this brought about a glorious revolution. As a result of that, you had the English Protestants. They said to William that they wanted a declaration of rights. And they wanted that declaration to include the right to bear arms, for example, because they wanted to be able to defend themselves against something like the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre. And so that was written into what became the English Bill of Rights, and 100 years later, that became the American Bill of Rights, or a modified version of it, I should say. It became our American Bill of Rights here in this country. But so much of what happened in England and in Europe with the Jesuits and their Counter-Reformation influenced the thinking of early American colonists. So we get to Samuel Adams here in 1772. 1772, Adams writes, he publishes The Rights of the Colonists in 1772. He talks about this issue of toleration, because there were two types of tolerance. There's tolerance that becomes a weapon of licentiousness that gives access to subversive groups. This is Jesuit toleration. But in contrast to that, you have the Protestant view of toleration, which is what Adams describes. He says this, he says, quote, "And it is now generally agreed among Christians that the spirit of toleration ought to be extended to all whose doctrines are not subversive of society." Then he says, "The Roman Catholics or Papists are excluded by reason of such doctrines as these, that princes excommunicated may be deposed, and those they call heretics may be destroyed without mercy, besides their recognizing the Pope in so absolute a manner in subversion of government by introducing imperium in imperio." Now that phrase imperium in imperio means literally an order within an order, a secret government within the established government. That's what that means. And so here Adams, of course, today would be called a conspiracy theorist. Introducing imperium in imperio, leading directly to the worst anarchy and confusion, civil discord, war, and bloodshed. And this is what the Jesuits were known for. They were known for for stirring up uprisings and revolutions to overturn countries to bring them back to Rome. Now, interestingly, in 1773, the Jesuits had caused so much trouble that even the Pope in 1773 abolished them with a perpetual decree. They were kicked out of all these countries, their fellow Catholics were mad at them, and part of the reason their fellow Catholics were mad at them is because they would always promote immorality and licentiousness, and they would find ways to justify immoral behavior as part of their programs. And so their fellow Catholics would get angry at them. So they were kicked out of all these countries, they stirred up all this trouble, and finally the Pope abolished them in 1773. Okay? Then they are reinstated in 1815. And then you have a quote from John Adams writing to Thomas Jefferson. And Adams says, he begins by saying, "I do not like the reappearance of the Jesuits." And he's writing to Thomas Jefferson. He says, quote, "If ever a congregation of men could merit eternal perdition on earth and in hell, it is this company of Loyola." And then he warned, he said, "Shall we not have swarms of them here in as many shapes and disguises as ever a king of the gypsies assumed?" Because the Jesuits were known for being masters of disguise. And so they would often masquerade themselves as Protestants, they would go in as Puritans, they would go in as Quakers, Presbyterians, Calvinists, etc. So they would often adopt Protestant teaching. And this is what Adams is referring to. Now, they were known not just for stirring up the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre. They were also believed to be behind what was called the Irish Rebellion of 1641, where over 100,000 Protestants were mass murdered in Northern Ireland. In fact, for those of you who you've heard mention Dr. Ronald Cook, who I've interviewed, he appears in two of our films, The History of the Bible. He's from Northern Ireland there in Ulster with Dr. Ian Paisley, the late Dr. Paisley. Dr. Cook is a lifelong friend of Dr. Paisley. And Dr. Ian Paisley believed that the Jesuits were behind the IRA and all of the IRA bombings and acts of terrorism and this kind of thing that went on for so many years in Northern Ireland. And the reason for the conflict there between the Catholics and the Protestants, you can trace all the way back to this period in the 17th century. And this Irish Rebellion, because the Jesuits had gone up there, stirred up the Catholic population and got them to go out and massacre all these Protestants. So they were behind St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre. They were behind the Irish Rebellion, 1641. They were behind the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, which was a document that protected the Protestants. And they overturned it in France. And this led to the mass murder of many Protestants as a result. They were behind the massacre of the Waldenses in 1655. So they were behind one instigated mass murder after another, as well as all of their political intrigues. All right, so this is the reason why, just to follow up, why Adams says if ever a congregation of men could merit eternal perdition, this is the reason why he says it. All right, so let's go now into the 19th century, because this influences a lot of what's happening in our country and in the Western world today. You had a movement called the Oxford Movement in the 19th century. It began in the 1830s, and it went really all the way through the 19th century. I believe it continues to this day. The Oxford Movement, in short, was an ongoing movement to convert the Protestant Church of England back to Rome. And they did it in a very covert manner. You had one of the guys who instigated it was named John Henry Newman. John Henry Newman literally was a Protestant minister. He travels to Rome. He meets with a Roman Catholic cardinal, Cardinal Wiseman, and he gives Cardinal Wiseman this plan that he had. And that is that he was going to continue to preach as a Protestant minister, but he would secretly begin looking for ways to deceive his congregation and get them to go back to Rome. And he did this for a number of years. He eventually converted, became a Catholic priest, and eventually became a cardinal, Cardinal John Henry Newman. Highly exalted in the Catholic Church today. Now, the thing about Newman is, Newman later admitted that he spent years lying to people. He admitted this in his writings. He adopted what he called the doctrine of the ancient Arians, the doctrine of reserve, where you reserve the truth to yourself and you lie to other people. As long as you're lying for a good reason, then it's not really lying. That was his view. And that was what, and he admitted to all this. Now, this is not a conspiracy theory. He admitted all this later. So in 1898, you have a book by a guy named Walter Walsh. It's called The Secret History of the Oxford Movement. Now, Newman was a part of all this, Rome was a part of it, and the Jesuits were very much a part of it. And there's a whole section in there talking about the activities of the Jesuits and all of these secret groups that were involved in churches. And they were introducing all of these doctrines that were intended to bring Protestants back to Rome. That's the whole purpose. Find ways to bring the Protestants back to Rome. And so at one point you have a conversation that was recorded where one of the Catholics who had come out of Catholicism, he converted to Protestantism partly because of this movement. And he said he was talking to his father confessor, and he said this, he said, quote, "I could not comprehend how a Jesuit could be a Protestant, or how a Protestant could be a Jesuit." He says, quote, "But my confessor silenced my scruples by telling me that St. Paul became as a Jew that he might save the Jews. It was no wonder, therefore, if a Jesuit should feign himself a Protestant for the conversion of Protestants." See, this was the whole philosophy, that it's okay, this is the end that justifies the means. It's okay to lie to people, it's okay to be dishonest, because the ultimate end is you're going to convert them back to Rome. Bring them back to the Pope. So that means whatever you have to do is acceptable. All right, in the 19th century, one of the prominent figures of the 19th century who warned about the activities of Rome and the Jesuits in America was a former Catholic priest named Charles Chiniquy. Charles Chiniquy was a Catholic priest and the personal friend of Abraham Lincoln. He wrote the book. He knew Lincoln for years before Lincoln became president of the United States. In fact, Lincoln had defended Chiniquy in court when he was still a lawyer, when Lincoln was just a lawyer. And Abraham Lincoln was Chiniquy's defense lawyer at one point. But Chiniquy wrote the book, 50 Years in the Church of Rome. In it, he asserted many things. One, that Rome has a desire to take over the United States of America. That is her desire. A lot of this goes back to the very foundation of America. Columbus, who was Catholic, Columbus discovers America supposedly 1492. We all know that. You know, Columbus sailed the ocean blue 1492, right? Well, in 1494, you had the Treaty of Tordesillas. And the Treaty of Tordesillas, the Pope literally drew a line down the map of the known world, and he gave half the world to Spain and the other half to Portugal, and told them to go out and conquer everything in the name of the Pope. That's why the Spanish came to the West. That's why they came here, and you had many Spanish missions and so on, because they were trying, that's why the Jesuits came here eventually, because they were trying to claim this part of the world for Rome. And so Chiniquy believes that their desire, he said this in the 19th century, is to reclaim, or really to claim America and ultimately rule this country. He also believed that the Jesuits were behind the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And he wrote much about this guy, a man named John Surratt. John Surratt was the son of Mary Surratt. Mary Surratt was one of the conspirators who was convicted in the conspiracy to kill Abraham Lincoln. Okay, they hunted down John Wilkes Booth, and then there were a number of conspirators who were all also condemned and hanged. One of them was Mary Surratt, the mother of John Surratt. If you were to go online and look up the wanted posters for John Wilkes Booth, you would find on many of them Booth is on one side, and the other side, they have a picture of John Surratt. According to Chiniquy, Surratt escaped the country through Canada, and he was found a year after the assassination of Lincoln. He was found a year later in Rome, and he was a member of the Pope's private bodyguard, the Suave Army. Okay, and this is him wearing his Suave uniform, a photograph of him in his Suave uniform. And he had said, while he was there, he had said to a friend of his, quote, "We have killed Lincoln, the Negro's friend." So he apparently admitted that, yes, he was a part of the plot to have Lincoln assassinated. And then he was extradited, brought back to America. He stood trial in this country. How many people remember being taught this when you were in school? Nobody, right? Nobody. But this is real history. This is the real history of what happened. He was extradited, brought back to this country. He stood trial. According to Chiniquy, there was a hung jury because there were Catholics on the jury who were manipulated to make sure that he was not convicted. When he died, it is said that John Surratt was given a high mass at his death, and he was presented with many, many honors by the Catholic Church. Many people don't know that during the American Civil War, the Vatican and the Pope was the one world power that officially recognized the Southern Confederacy. In other words, the Vatican sided with the Southern Confederacy and with slavery. And according to Chiniquy, the reason that the conflict became violent was because a Catholic leader named Beauregard, who was a rabid Roman Catholic, Beauregard at Fort Sumter fired the first shots of the Civil War. This is Chiniquy's account now. This is what he says. And that the reason he did was because the Pope had officially recognized Jefferson Davis, and therefore he felt he had to fight against Lincoln. And Chiniquy even went so far as to argue the impression that he gives you is that the Civil War would not have needed to happen. In other words, it would not have been violent if it had not been for the instigation of Rome. That's the impression he gives you. Because remember, in England, they phased out slavery one step at a time, but they did it peaceably. They didn't have a civil war. In America, we had a civil war. All right, so he quotes Abraham Lincoln at one point in his book, and he says this. Lincoln reportedly, according to Chiniquy, said, quote, "It is not against the Americans of the South alone I am fighting. It is more against the Pope of Rome, his perfidious Jesuits, and their blind and bloodthirsty slaves." That's a quote. Now, it's on record that Chiniquy knew Lincoln, and he met him at the White House on a number of occasions. So that much is recorded. This is Chiniquy's account of what Lincoln said to him during their conversations. I will tell you this. Chiniquy's book was widely published in the 19th century. It was affirmed by another Catholic priest named Emmett McLaughlin in the 20th century, who wrote the book, An Inquiry into the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln. So you have a second Catholic priest who affirmed Chiniquy's findings. And I can tell you, there's yet a third book called Who Killed Abraham Lincoln by a Canadian author named Paul Serup. And if anybody wanted to do more research, Serup spent more than 20 years investigating the claims of Chiniquy. The reason is because Chiniquy was a Canadian originally, and Serup is from Canada, so he just was fascinated by it, researched his account. Paul Serup came to the conclusion that Chiniquy was telling the truth, and his book, Who Killed Abraham Lincoln, was carried for a time at the Ford Theater in Washington, D.C., after they investigated the book for a year. So I tell you all of that just so you understand there's a lot of information, a lot of details that typically are kept out of our history books, kept out of the mainstream, kept out of our schools, colleges, universities. All right, one of the more, I think, powerful historians who wrote about the Jesuits, and really, J.A. Wiley is a great Protestant historian. He's got a four-volume series, if you're not familiar with it, called The History of Protestantism, which I highly recommend for anybody who wants to learn about Protestantism from a Protestant perspective, pre-20th century history. But he also wrote about the Jesuits, and he said this. He said, quote, "To what country of Europe shall we turn where we are not able to track the Jesuit by his bloody footprints? How many assassins they sent to England to murder Elizabeth?" According to EIPS, the European Institute of Protestant Studies, the Jesuits tried more than 25 times to assassinate Queen Elizabeth I. More than 25 times. How many assassins they sent to England to murder Elizabeth? The very sanctuary of their own popes, they have defiled with blood. The Jesuits are, well, they're on record for the assassination of Pope Clement, who abolished the order in 1773. I'm going to tell you more about that here in a minute, because it has everything to do with what's happening in our world today. But anyway, they assassinated Pope Clement. It is also believed by people like Malachi Martin that they were behind the assassination of Pope John Paul I in the 20th century, who reigned for only 33 days and then died mysteriously. Malachi Martin, who was an ex-Jesuit priest, said he was poisoned. All right, so the very sanctuary of their own popes, they have defiled with blood. In the gunpowder plot, we see them. They lay the train of that crowning horror, the St. Bartholomew Day Massacre. Also remember, brothers and sisters, the St. Bartholomew Day, there was a book written years ago that was supported by the NRA, and the book was called To Keep and Bear Arms by Joyce Lee Malcolm. In that book, the author states that the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre and what happened had a lot to do with why Protestants developed the right to keep and bear arms in England and then brought the same to America. All right, Wiley says, quote, "What a harvest of plots, tumults, seditions, revolutions, torturings, poisonings, assassinations, regicides, and massacres has Christendom reaped from the seed sown by the Jesuits." And I'm often asked about this. I'll explain it to you. It was estimated by John Dowling in the 19th century that over a period of at least 600 years of papal inquisition and so on, that some 50 million Christian martyrs were put to death, were murdered by Rome. Many people don't understand the Inquisition. They don't realize, they think that the Inquisition was when people tried to impose Christianity by force, this kind of thing. They don't realize that was not the Inquisition. The Inquisition outlawed the Bible. The Inquisition outlawed preaching the gospel. You could not read a Bible. The Lollard preachers in England were arrested. When they were found with Bibles, they were condemned and they had their Bibles chained to their necks. And then they were burnt at the stake, burnt alive, what were they guilty of? They were reading the Word of God, and they were teaching it to the people. The Inquisition outlawed preaching the gospel. The Inquisition outlawed the Ten Commandments. You have on record parents that were put to death because they were teaching their children the Ten Commandments. That was the Inquisition. And I personally believe the reason they don't want you to know what the real Inquisition was about, because if you knew what the Inquisition was about, you'd say, wait a second, this sounds a lot like the ACLU and the Southern Poverty Law Center. This sounds a lot more like the Democratic Party and this radical, militant, atheist movement going on in our country. And you'd be right. You'd be right. And they come from the same origin. But see, many people don't understand it, unfortunately. But the 50 million Christian martyrs number, I have to say this briefly, because when we did A Lamp in the Dark, we talked about this, we quoted John Dowling, and then I would get emails and phone calls from people saying, okay, where do you have support for 50 million martyrs? The source I'll give you that's the best I've found, there's a number of sources pre-20th century. In modern times, you have Professor David A. Plastid, from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He has an essay that you can find online called Estimates of the Number Killed by the Papacy. And he gives you all the documentation for who they were, where they were, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, for those who want to do more research. Okay, Sir Edward Coke, spelled like Coke, pronounced Cook. 1605, he was the lawyer who prosecuted the gunpowder treason of 1605. Now, the gunpowder plot of 1605, if anybody ever saw the movie V for Vendetta, you know that film? V for Vendetta, the beginning, they quote from the poem of the Gunpowder Plot, "Remember, remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder treason and plot." Well, there's a number of versions of that poem. One of the versions is, "Remember, remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder treason and plot. I'll give you a reason why Jesuit treason never should be forgot. Shout, boys, shout, let the ring bells ring, down with the Jesuits and God save the king." And it's a big long poem from there. But the reason is because it was believed throughout England that the Jesuits were behind the gunpowder plot, where, for those who don't remember, Guy Fawkes brought hundreds of barrels of gunpowder beneath the Houses of Parliament and was planning to blow them up and blast the Parliament of England to smithereens and likely kill King James I. And then what they had planned was to blow up Parliament and then have the country invaded by Catholic forces and set up a Catholic government to reclaim England for Rome. If you see modern histories on this, because I've seen them on documentaries and so on, modern histories are rewriting our history books. And what they will often do is they'll mention Father Henry Garnett, who was a Jesuit, and they'll say, "Poor Father Garnett," because he was condemned and put to death. And they'll say, "Poor Father Garnett, he really wasn't behind this whole thing. He was blamed for it," and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then they'll blame Guy Fawkes, that Guy Fawkes supposedly did it by himself, who was a Spanish soldier. But according to Edward Cook and the records at the time, it wasn't just Father Garnett. Here's what Cook says. He says, quote, "I never knew a treason without a Romish priest. But in this, there are very many Jesuits." And in the trial, he names all these different Jesuits all over Europe, because it was a whole collection of them, a whole network of them, that were planning this thing. And Fawkes was really their pawn. They put Guy Fawkes up to doing the gunpowder part, but they were handling all the politics and all the planning. All right, so he says, "I never knew a treason without a Romish priest, but in this there are very many Jesuits, men that use the sacred and blessed name of Jesus as a mantle to cover their impiety, blasphemy, treason, rebellion, and all manner of wickedness." In fact, if you study the history of the order, it is often said of them, they use the warning of our Lord Jesus Christ, who said, "Beware of false prophets that come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves." That was used over and over and over again by the reformers about the Jesuit order in particular. The play Macbeth, Shakespeare's Macbeth. And we all, when we went to high school, we had to read Macbeth. But how many people remember being told that Macbeth was a powder play, meaning it was written after the gunpowder plot and about the gunpowder plot, and that it was an allegory of the Jesuit order? Apparently, the plot for Macbeth, where you have the witches manipulating Macbeth at the beginning, and they're telling Macbeth that he's going to become the next king and this kind of thing, they're manipulating him, this was all a picture of what they believed was going on with the Jesuits, how they manipulated Guy Fawkes. So Macbeth is like Guy Fawkes, and the witches at the beginning, who have, they have breasts like women, but they have beards like men, probably a picture of Rome as Mystery Babylon, the great harlot. And so you have the book Witches and Jesuits by Gary Wills. Gary Wills is a Pulitzer Prize winning author. And he alleges, one review of his book by F. Tucker Saucy is that, according to Wills, quote, "Macbeth is an elaborate condemnation of the Jesuits as Satanists, murderers, and witches." Satanists, murderers, and witches. If you were to go then to a Webster's Dictionary in the year 1828, and you look up the word Jesuitism, the definition for Jesuitism is, quote, "the arts, principles, and practices of the Jesuits, cunning, deceit, prevarication, deceptive practices to effect a purpose." Prior to the 20th century, the Jesuits were nefarious, and they were known by all Protestants. They were known throughout the, really out throughout the Western world. And again, because they've been expelled from countries so many times, What's remarkable is that after World War I and World War II, the history books began to be rewritten in our country. And now today, in high school, college, university, students are taught virtually nothing about Jesuits. Anything that I've ever seen anybody teach about the Jesuits is usually something positive. You know, that they're this very interesting group of priests, they're adventurous, and they're very intellectual, and on and on and on. But nothing about all of the murders, the assassinations, the atrocities that they're known for throughout history. The Jesuit oath is said to be, and this was published several hundred years ago, but the Jesuit oath, part of it is, it's a long oath, but part of it says the Jesuit is sworn to, quote, "Go ye then into all the world and take possession of all lands in the name of the Pope. He who will not accept him as the vicar of Jesus and his vice regent on earth, let him be accursed and exterminated." Now it's believed this is why you have Jesuit missions all over the world, in China, in Japan, in India, in countries around the world. Quite literally, the Jesuits are very involved, not just theologically, but especially politically. Napoleon Bonaparte talked about the Jesuits. He said, quote, "The Jesuits are a military organization, not a religious order. And the aim of this organization is power, power to control the world by the volition of a single man." And of course, that single man is really the Pope. But what's interesting, if you study the history, behind the Pope, the Jesuit general, the chief of the Jesuits, is called the general, the superior general. And he is often called the Black Pope. That's the nickname they have for him. There was even a book written in the early part of the 20th century by a former nun named M.F. Cusack. And she wrote the book, The Black Pope, wherein she basically said that the Black Pope, the Jesuit general, is the real power behind the White Pope. That the Jesuit general manipulates the Pope and tells him what to do, tells him what to say, etc. There is lots of confirmation for this past and present. When I was doing research for Bridge to Babylon, I was studying the writings of Westcott and Hort. A lot of people write about Westcott and Hort and their revision of the Bible and this kind of thing. And I was reading one of Hort's letters to Westcott, and he's talking about the Vatican, and he says, well, the Pope will probably do this if the Jesuits will let him. That's what he says. Just a passing comment. He's not even really writing about the Jesuits. He says, oh, the Pope will do this if the Jesuits let him. Because it's generally understood that the Jesuits manipulate the Pope. Even with Pope Francis, you can go read some of these articles. Before Pope Francis would come out and give speeches, he would often have a collection of Jesuits that would come in. They would fly in from all over the world, go meet him in a clandestine meeting. And the other Catholic groups are kind of murmuring about it because they don't know what's going on. And they're basically telling him what to say. The Pope is kind of like the Jesuits' idol. And they ultimately want everyone to bow down to the Pope. Papal supremacy is not only political, but I think the deadliest aspect of it is theological. You have these declarations from the papacy in history. Pope Boniface VIII said famously, quote, "We declare, say, define, and pronounce that it is absolutely necessary for the salvation of every human creature that they be subject to the Roman Pontiff." So the papacy has taught, not only do you have to be in submission to the Catholic Church, you have to be in submission to the Pope himself. In the 19th century, you have Jesuit leaders talking about the salvation of the world. Whenever they talk about the salvation of the world, what they mean is finding a way to bring the whole world in submission to the Pope. And the method that they seem to have chosen here in modern times is ecumenism. The idea of joining all the various world religions into a single religious body and then bringing them together under the Pope. In fact, if you study Vatican Council II, Vatican II that really began to manifest that idea, all of the writers of Vatican II, the chief writers, were Jesuits. All right, Pope Clement VI said this, "No man outside obedience to the Pope of Rome can ultimately be saved." all who have raised themselves against the faith of the Roman Church and died in final impenitence have been damned and gone down to hell. That's what he said. Now, this idea of papal supremacy continues into the 20th century. Pope John XXIII in 1958, at his coronation homily, John XXIII was the pope who brought in Vatican Council II. He said, quote, "Into this fold of Jesus Christ, no man may enter unless he be led by the sovereign pontiff, and only if they be united to him can men be saved." In other words, you've got to be united to the pope, you've got to be in submission to the pope. Everything with the Church of Rome, and especially with the Jesuits, is about submission to the papacy. And when Sam Adams, if you think back on the quote I showed you earlier from Samuel Adams, when he talks about papists and how they hold the pope in such high regard and this kind of thing, that is what leads them to start wars and discord and uprisings and things like this to try and overturn countries and to get them to submit to Rome. Now, here is a book that we've carried for a while. I don't know, they may have it over there with Dr. Ronald Cook's stuff, but it's a fantastic book. It's called The Jesuit Culture Conf in the United States. The Jesuit Culture Conf. Culture Conf means culture war. And there was a culture war that went on in Germany. And Dr. Cook writes about what he believes is the Jesuit culture war in the United States. I believe there's a number of elements to it, just sort of building off his theme, that are very important and that I think Christians should be aware of everywhere. One, biblical criticism, or higher criticism, or what I would call biblical skepticism. Tom was talking about it earlier when he talks about how they undermined the Bible. In our whole history of the Bible, we show you what they did in the 19th century. The fact that you had the Vatican working with guys like Tischendorf and others, and they were manipulating the manuscripts that they use to ultimately change the Bible. But what they really did was they ushered in a biblical theory, a theory about the Bible that if you believe it and you follow it to its logical conclusion, you are basically convinced that the Bible cannot really be the inspired, inerrant Word of God. That's the ultimate conclusion of biblical criticism. And biblical criticism was really built upon principles of evolution. Evolution, even though we know it from Darwin from 1859, you can trace it back 200 years earlier to the Counter-Reformation. You had a Jesuit named Alfonso Salmeron. He laid the groundwork for it. But then you had a guy who converted to Catholicism who wrote a book called Men Before Adam about a pre-Adamite race, that supposedly there were men on the earth 50,000 years before Adam and Eve. His name was Isaac La Pereire. That was his name. La Pereire and his book, Men Before Adam. And what happened was he was sought out by a Catholic priest named Richard Simon, who was also working on the Counter Reform. And Richard Simon noted that many Protestants were disturbed at this idea that there were men on the earth 50,000 years before Adam and Eve. And they said, well, how could Genesis be true if there were people on the earth 50,000 years? And of course, it was all just a theory. He had no way of proving it. But he used the word science. And so what happened was Richard Simon seeks him out, and he noted this was a very effective way to undermine the credibility of the Bible. And this was the approach that the Jesuits took and that the Counter-Reformation took. Because the Protestant argument is that the Bible is the inspired, inerrant Word of God. And the foundation of the Protestant argument is sola scriptura, only the scriptures. Because Jesus said, man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. If you were to go to a Catholic website right now, go to the Catholic Encyclopedia, and you look up online the word Protestantism in the Catholic Encyclopedia, they will tell you, they will give you their definition of Protestantism, and then they tell you the number one error of Protestantism is the doctrine of sola scriptura. And in the 19th century, during the Oxford movement, you had those that were teaching that Protestantism, or not that Protestantism, but that Bible-based Christianity was, quote, the invention of the devil. That's how much they fought against it. So biblical criticism is about, or historic criticism as they call it, or higher criticism. You've probably heard the term higher criticism. What it really is where you go through the pages of history and you try to find historic events, you compare those historic events to the Bible, and then you say, well, look, history says this, and the Bible says something different, so that must mean the Bible is wrong. That's it in a nutshell. And evolution is really the foundation of biblical criticism. Also, in the 19th century, the Jesuits developed socialism and communism as weapons of the Counter-Reformation. All right, I want to play you this clip. Here is a clip from the late Dr. Ian Paisley in Northern Ireland. And he talks about the Jesuits and their manipulation of the Bible.
And it's not the word of man, it's the word of God. Now, of course, don't use to burn the Bible. He used to burn the people that translated it. He used to burn the people that read them. But that didn't succeed. So she decided upon another scheme. That she would place her Jesuit priest in the training of Protestant ministers. And so into the universities of Germany, Rome set at work the whole structure of unbelieving higher criticism. And she had in the university men who sought to destroy belief in the Bible. And they became cursed with what was known as higher criticism. And young men had their faith in the Bible destroyed in the university and in the training college. And so the men that came out to be ordained didn't believe a book. They didn't believe the creeds of the church. They didn't believe in the historic Christian faith. And they set to work to destroy the faith.
All right, so you can see Dr. Paisley, he had no questions or doubts about the origins of higher criticism. And of course, if you study the history of it, it all leads to Rome. It all leads to Rome, but the beginnings of it, it began as part of the Counter-Reformation. That's how it began. All right, so from evolution is really the foundation of higher criticism. Evolutionary principles, the same principles that they argue. Now, coming into the 20th century, you have Teilhard de Chardin. Teilhard de Chardin was a very famous Jesuit priest in the 20th century. He is sometimes called the father of the New Age. Years ago, you had a New Age writer named Marilyn Ferguson, and she wrote a book called The Aquarian Conspiracy. And what she did was she sent out all these letters to these New Age teachers and thinkers throughout the world, and she asked them who their number one influence was in life. And the number one person who turned up was Father Teilhard de Chardin, the Jesuit priest, because he was a Catholic priest. He was also a paleontologist. He's called the father of the New Age because he championed the idea of evolution. Teilhard also worked on the Piltdown Man hoax in 1912. Now, the Piltdown Man hoax, many people don't understand, but what happened was Darwin set forth his theory, 1859. Some people embraced it, other people thought, well, this is just nonsense, but it really didn't gain any traction. It was just controversial. Then in 1912, they discovered Piltdown Man. And for 40 years, Piltdown Man was believed to be genuine, a genuine missing link that confirmed Darwin's theory of evolution. So during that time, you had all of these materials that were written and drafted, put into the schools, colleges, universities, etc. Then 40 years later, they discovered Piltdown Man was a hoax, but they had already ushered in Darwin's evolution. Now, the interesting thing about Teilhard is Teilhard worked with Charles Dawson, who actually made the discovery. You had a Harvard professor named Stephen Jay Gould, he's got a book out there and an essay where he basically argues that Teilhard helped create the Piltdown Man hoax. He believes Teilhard helped create the Piltdown Man hoax. Teilhard also worked on the Peking Man discovery, which is another very suspicious so-called discovery, where they claim they found all of these evolutionary bones in a cave in China, and they were evidence of missing links and all sorts of kind of stuff. And they took pictures of the bones, they wrote down all kinds of stuff, and then somehow all of the evidence disappeared. Just poof, went away. But thankfully they still have the photographs and the notes that were made by the scientists. So you can trust whatever they tell you, but you can't actually examine the evidence. That was the thing with Peking Man. Teilhard now took this, he wasn't just a paleontologist, but he wrote extensively about what this means. And he argued, he said, now that evolution has been proved, he says, it is a curve that every line must follow. It is a hypothesis to which all other hypotheses must bow. Everything now must bow to evolution, including our understanding of God. Now we have to understand Christ as the cosmic Christ, the Christ of all nations. Right? So we have to develop an evolutionary idea of God. And from that, what they've done, from Teilhard to Vatican II, the idea that our understanding of God is evolving, whereas before, they would say, we believe Jesus was the way, the truth, and the life, and that no man comes unto the Father but by him. Yes, that's an old paradigm that we believed way back then. But now we're evolving in our understanding. Now we understand that Jesus and Buddha and Krishna and Muhammad, etc., and all these other different avatars or way-showers are just as valid. That's the idea. That's what they do with evolution. They don't just want it for the science, because it's really not scientific. They really want it for the theology, so they can evolve the concept of God. Many people may not know that the father of the Big Bang Theory was a Catholic priest named George Lemaître. George Lemaître was Jesuit educated. He was educated by a Jesuit priest. He is the guy who actually came up with the Big Bang Theory. And the story goes, according to one researcher, a guy named Louis Buff Perry, that when George Lemaître gave this theory before an audience of intellectuals, Albert Einstein was there, his friend Albert Einstein, who he's standing with in this photo. And supposedly, Lemaître gave a speech about how all the matter in the universe began from a single tiny dot, and it blew up and went outward. And after he gave the theory, Einstein is said to have stood up and applauded wildly and said, oh, this is a brilliant idea. And that's what ushered in the Big Bang Theory. Everybody said, oh, Einstein thinks it's a great idea. Well, then let's put that in all the school books, and we'll teach that to the kids. And so that's how the Big Bang Theory was ushered in. But it was a Catholic priest who was trained by the Jesuit order. Luigi Taparelli, a Jesuit from 1843, first coined the phrase social justice. You know the phrase social justice? A very common phrase in modern times. This is really the beginning of what would become socialism and communism. You can trace this back to the time of the French Revolution. Many researchers, myself included, believe the Jesuits were ultimately behind the French Revolution because the ideas of the French Revolution come from the University of Ingolstadt in Bavaria that was a Jesuit university. And what happened was in 1773, the Jesuits were abolished by the Pope. Then, in 1776, you had this group 3 years later that formed at the University of Ingolstadt. And they developed the ideas that launched the French Revolution. And the French Revolution is now this secular humanist movement where they've abolished the idea of God. They get rid of Protestantism, they get rid of Catholicism. Now, my theory is that the reason they did this was because they wanted revenge on their fellow Catholics. So they needed a weapon that they could use to fight against both Protestants and Catholics who would not do what they wanted. Okay? And the reason I believe that is because by the time you get to 1881, you have J.A. Wiley, and he says that the Jesuits used communism as a weapon against countries they are trying to control. But there's a lot of information about the Jesuits and their work with Adolf Hitler. There is a book by an author named Edmond Paris, who was a French journalist in the 20th century. According to Paris, the Jesuits were heavily involved with Hitler. Hitler once said, quote, "I learned much from the order of the Jesuits." Paris says, quote, "Another Jesuit father, Stemfel, was the unrecognized author of Mein Kampf." According to Paris, it was a Jesuit who was the real author of Hitler's Mein Kampf, his famous novel that basically became his manifesto. So there you have Hitler, National Socialism, the same ideas that the Jesuits were promoting in the 19th century, basically came to fruition through Hitler and the Nazi movement. Hitler even patterned the SS after the Jesuit order. He openly called Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, his Ignatius Loyola. Another quote from Hitler, Hitler said that his Nazi movement was the exact counterpart of the French Revolution. He said the French Revolution, that's really the foundation for all of these radical Marxist revolutions. In fact, how many people know that Mary Shelley wrote her novel Frankenstein as an allegory of the French Revolution? Anybody ever taught that? But the idea was, this is why Dr. Frankenstein in the book goes to the University of Ingolstadt. That's where he gets all these ideas. But it's the idea of man playing God, getting rid of God from government and your system and everything. Now man is going to stay, you know, in the position of God. And he's going to create the new man by all of these man-made ideas and philosophies. And Mary Shelley wrote the book, apparently, from what I've read, she wrote the book because initially she supported the French Revolution. She thought they had very good ideas, etc. But then what happened was, as it became unleashed, it really turned into a nightmare, turned into the Reign of Terror, and many of the people who originally supported it ended up being destroyed by it. And that's the picture that you have in the story of Frankenstein. Dr. Frankenstein creates this creature, and the creature becomes a monster and comes back to destroy his entire household. That's the idea. Karl Marx. Now the connections between the Jesuits and Karl Marx are very, very interesting. One, we read that, now notice, Luigi Taparelli coined the phrase social justice in 1843. 5 years later is when Marx publishes the Communist Manifesto, 1848. And here's a quote, you can find this online, lots of places. That Karl Marx spent 5 years from 1830 to 1835 at the Jesuit High School in Trier. So he had a Jesuit education, or was influenced by the Jesuits during his education. We have an audio CD called The Jesuits and Marxism, Weapon of the Counter-Reformation. There's a lot of information. Obviously, we don't have time tonight. But the influence of the Jesuits on Karl Marx is well documented. In fact, in the 19th century, Otto von Bismarck in Germany openly published in the German newspapers his belief that Karl Marx was in league with the Jesuit general at the time. Marx even talked about this in an interview that he did with the Chicago Tribune, which you can also find online. Of course, Marx denied it. He didn't want to admit that he was somehow or other involved with a Jesuit order. But as a result of this, von Bismarck kicked the Jesuits out of Germany. So this was not just a light-hearted idea that he thought he had. And if you study what was going on in the 19th century, all of these Marxist radical revolutionary movements were stirring up trouble all over Europe. So this is part of the reason why the Jesuits were being kicked out of Spain, they were kicked out of Germany, they were kicked out of Switzerland. They're being driven out of these countries because it's believed that they are behind a lot of this Marxist radical revolutionary stuff. Even if today, if you go to go to the Georgetown University website, Georgetown University, which is a Jesuit university, very political, just scan their website. It is all left-wing Marxist pro-democratic party stuff. That's all it is. Hillary Clinton, when she ran for president, her running mate was Tim Kaine, who bragged and boasted about being Jesuit educated, and that he had gone to see this well-known Jesuit, an Incarni down in Honduras, or wherever it was, who was a well-known Marxist, well-known communist. Yeah, the Jesuits are very openly Marxist today. But what's behind all of this? This is where I want to wrap this thing up and remind us that we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness, as the scripture warns us. There is a very powerful book called Marx and Satan by Richard Wurmbrand. Richard Wurmbrand, of course, was a Protestant minister. He spent 14 years in a communist prison. In his book, Marx and Satan, what he talks about is the fact that while he was in prison, the viciousness of the communists toward Christians was unbelievable, he said. There was a demonic hatred that they had against Christian people, to the point that they wanted to hurt them and humiliate them in every way humanly possible. They would do mock communions, mock crucifixions, all this stuff to torture and beat and demoralize the Christian prisoners. So Wurmbrand dealt with this for 14 years, and he was determined, when he got out, to find out what was behind it. So he spent years investigating Karl Marx and came to the conclusion that Marx was not really an atheist, as many people thought, but that he had a hatred against God. And he discovered all these different writings from Karl Marx where he says things like, quote, "I wish to avenge myself against the one who rules above." That's a quote from Karl Marx. He wrote a poem called Pale Maiden. Pale Maiden, where he said, because Karl Marx, when he was a teenager, he was a professing Christian. He claimed he was a Christian. He would write all these things about the devotion to Jesus Christ and all this other kind of stuff. And then when he went to college, something happened. And his heart turned away from God. And he just became very dark and anti-Christ and anti-God. And something happened to make him angry, and then he wanted revenge against God. And so for Marx, atheism was like a weapon that he used against God and against God's people. And so this is what Wurmbrand discovered. But he discovered all of these Marxist revolutionaries from the 19th century, and one of them after another, he gives all of these different quotes, where they're all celebrating Satan, Lucifer, rebellion. The communist Florins, for example, their motto was, "Our enemy is God. Hatred against God is the beginning of wisdom." And so when you know all of them, you read this whole background of Marxism. I mean, in the Soviet Union, apparently, they had an inner circle that called itself hell, literally. Called themselves hell. So when you learn all of this, and then you get to the 20th century with Saul Alinsky, and Alinsky dedicates his book to Lucifer, he's just one in a long line of Marxists who had this fascination with, literally, the powers of hell, powers of darkness. All right, so now tying all of this into the Vatican, Malachi Martin was a former Jesuit priest. In the 20th century, he warned about things that were going on in Rome, and he warned about the demonic powers literally at work inside the Vatican in Rome. And I wanted to play this clip. It's pretty brief, but it's partly a radio interview with Malachi Martin before he died. So let's listen.
We consider this interview with the late Malachi Martin, a former Jesuit priest and author of a best-selling book on the history of the Jesuit order. In this interview, Martin reveals what are said to be the dark powers at work in Rome.
Father, I've got an article here entitled "Two Eminent Churchmen Agree."
Yeah.
That there actually is, this is a shocker to a lot of people.
Yeah.
That there are satanic practices going on at the Vatican. Could that be true?
Yes. Now, when we say in the Vatican, the Vatican doesn't meddle. And there's no doubt about it that there have been and still are practices that are formally venerating Lucifer, the prince of this world.
All right, now that was Malachi Martin. He's one source on that. Remember, Martin's writings are embraced by many people who work inside the Vatican. There's another priest who also passed away named Gabriel Amorth, who came out. You can find articles on him. But he openly said that Satan was being worshipped in the Vatican in Rome. Now, We all remember, and certainly the Trinity Foundation has talked about this for years, but the great meeting in Assisi, Italy in 1986 with Pope John Paul II, where he brought in all of these different leaders of world religions. We had Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims and American Indian shaman, and you had snake charmers and fire worshippers, literally all these different world religious leaders who met with the Pope, and they all joined hands together and they said, we're all praying to the same God. That's what they said. Now, I have always seen that event, and of course that's continued to this day. The Jesuits, this is what they were known for. This is where they tie into all of this. In the Middle Ages, they were known in their missions when they would go out. They were known for adopting pagan practices and joining with the pagans. They would take paganism and Catholicism and blend it together in a way that even the Catholic Church believed was heretical, okay, and unorthodox. And of course, many of us know that much of Rome anyway is a blend of old world paganism with so-called Christianity. But they would take it even a step further, where they were so bad, even their fellow Catholics thought, this is flat out heresy, it's unorthodox, etc. And so their development of this idea that all religions are one and the same, this largely comes from them, through their practices and so on, and their writings in Vatican Council too. Now I've seen this as being part of the fulfillment of Revelation 18:2, which says, quote, Babylon the Great is fallen, is become the habitation of devils and the hold of every foul spirit and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. When you think about that, in the Bible we're told that behind all of these idols, these pagan idols, are demonic powers, are demons. Paul says to the Corinthians, he says, I tell you that the sacrifice which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to devils and not to God. He says, I would not that you had fellowship with devils. You cannot eat from the table of the Lord and the table of demons. You cannot drink from the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons, lest we provoke God to anger. So, it's very, very clear. It would appear that what's happening, now the current Pope, Pope Francis, he's got a video out there where you have the Pope sitting at this table and he's talking about all the world religions. And then they show a Catholic priest, they show an Orthodox Jew, they show a Muslim, they show a Hindu, and then they show a Buddhist, and they're all there professing the faith in their different religions. And Pope Francis is talking about them like they're all one and the same thing. And this is the direction they're moving in. I believe it's the fulfillment of prophecy. Rome has become the habitation of devils, the hold of every foul spirit, because all of these world religions are gathering at Rome and at the instigation of Rome herself. But, and I want to finish on this because I think it's very important, Revelation 18:4, as we witness to those who are members of the Catholic Church. And I know many people here probably come out of a Catholic background. I know me, my sister, my brother-in-law, we all come from Catholic families. And thank the Lord, we're God-fearing, Bible-believing Protestant evangelicals today. But Revelation 18:4 says, and I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. That there are some of God's people, somehow or other, bound up in this system, this Babylonian harlot. And it's our responsibility to call them to come out. To come out and believe the salvation of the Lord and to turn away from this mother of harlots. Because what's going on with the ecumenical movement, many people in the evangelical world think that what's happening is that the popes and that the Vatican wants to join all the different Christian groups together. The Catholics, Protestants, Greek and Russian Orthodox, and all of that sounds good to a lot of people, but they don't realize that what they want to do is join all the professing Christians over here and then bring them and join them with all the pagans over here. They don't realize that this is, it's not at all what they think. They like the idea of Christian unity, but of course you can't be unified with people who simply don't believe the gospel. That's the problem. That is the issue, and so we continue to fight the good fight of faith and preach the gospel to every creature. Praise the Lord. All right, you guys, that is it for my presentation. Thank you for listening. God bless you. I'll see you all tomorrow.